Well, good morning and welcome to Season 2 of Food Conversations, a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, and with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap and surrounding area. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. As I've mentioned before, environmental challenges are increasing, and food sovereignty, that's having access to local, healthy food, becomes an increasingly high priority. For example, did you know that shipping 2 pounds of organic corn from Mexico generates nearly 14 times as much greenhouse gas as corn grown and bought locally? So we have jobs to do, and it's probably a big job is changing the food system that we have. And today, we're delighted to have two people who are doing just that on a daily basis. I'm delighted to welcome Steve Meggett and Annalise Grube Cavers, who are the co-owners and operators of Fresh Valley Farms in Armstrong. Welcome, Steve and Annalise.
Hi, Warren.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Absolutely delighted to have you here. You run what you have described, I think, very accurately as a vertically integrated farm. And on that farm, you raise animals on your own pasture. And those animals include beef, pork, chicken, and turkey. I shouldn't call a pig pork. That's afterwards.
That's our product.
That's your product. We're going to talk about your farm a lot more in our next show, but today, as has happened many times in this show, we've explored how people get to be doing what you're doing. You're in a sort of 21st century farm, the kind of farm that people want more and more to grow their food. But it didn't just happen, as it never happens in anybody's life, because you just sprang out of the earth fully grown and ready to go. You had the origins that all the rest of us have, which is getting into it by degrees. So I thought we could start with some origin stories from the Meggett and Grube Cavers family circle. Now, Steve, you grew up in Armstrong on what was a conventional farm, but it wasn't exactly conventional because, as you said, your dad was a little outside the box. What kind of a farm was it actually?
Most of the time it was just a beef farm, or just really just a cow-calf operation. There's, he did a little bit of finishing for neighbors, but mostly just sold at the auction. And then he got into grain growing and then eventually organic grain, when I was a teenager.
And were you aware of that as a kid? I mean, it was obviously something that was going on around you, but do you think, oh, organic, that's where I'm going? Or did you just like grow up with it?
As a teenager, I think I didn't really take a lot of note of what he was doing other than working.
Yeah, that's what teenagers do.
My goal was to get to town as much as possible when I was a teenager.
to break away from the farm. Yeah. Now, Annalise, you grew up a little west of here in Chase, and your family grew vegetables, berries, corn, and grew it organically.
Well, yeah, my dad had a certified organic farm in, I think, even in the 70s, like before it was really a thing. Our farm in Chase, it wasn't certified organic for most of my life, but it was like spray-free kind of. The in-between.
So back then, there wasn't organic certification in the 70s in BC, was there?
I'm not actually sure. That's a good question. I've never talked to my dad about those earliest days in terms of certification. Yeah. I know that they were certified in Chase in the beginning. And again, it was one of those choices for him. The fish fertilizer that he was able to get that was organic was coming from Texas. And so he had kind of a moral quandary with that. Why am I shipping this all the way across the continent? But I think we have a different understanding now of the impact of fertilizers and the importance of them being
Well, just to make you feel a little bit better, my father used to order Milorganite from Milwaukee, and it was shipped to our home in Vancouver, where unbeknownst to me, we were doing organic growing of vegetables just in a home garden. But while all the neighbors were resorting to pesticides, we were the family that didn't use them and dug the orange peels into the garden, which was
Agriculture Canada really supported that kind of agriculture, right? In I guess the 50s and 60s, because not my mother's father farmed that land in Chase before my parents did, and he used kind of horrible stuff that's banned now, and he actually died of melanoma. And
dear me,
yeah, very. Just really common among farmers. And my mom remembers him going out and spraying with no protective equipment, no gloves, nothing. Mm. I mean, it was just kind of standard practice. So that really galvanized my mom around kind of pesticide-free issues and into the organic community.
Sure. And now we're, as a physician, I'm very well aware of the growing rates of things like lymphoma among farmers who use the range of pesticides, and especially now that there's a massive increase in the use of glyphosate-containing pesticides, which do alter genetic material. They have genotoxic effects. So you were early, and you were right, and the rightness of what you were doing then is now becoming clear practically every day. So did you, as I was saying with Steve, did you, growing up in this farm, were you sort of thinking about that, or was it just what your family did, which is usually what it is?
Yeah, I think it was just what was happening around me. I definitely, as a young person, I think I was really proud of the way that we grew food. Like, there was a lot of pride in that, but we also sold at farmers markets direct to consumers. And right. So it was a part of that community that I had grown up in. And to me, that always felt really special, but I didn't have a very strong connection with the farming operation. I kind of realized when I was a teenager, really how little I knew about the farm and about what was happening there, because I didn't, aside from picking berries as piecework as a child, I was not involved and didn't really want to be.
Yeah, well, that's a common feeling. My parents do this, but that's not what I do. Steve, you didn't go into the sort of family farming business. Your first kind of work was involved with woodworking and custom finishing and that kind of stuff, construction.
Yeah, pretty early on out of high school, I moved to Vancouver and started doing some custom woodworking in a little shop right downtown. It was pretty cool. We did like pieces that were in the Granville Island Wood Co-op and stuff like that. So yeah, I definitely enjoyed the creative woodworking field.
So did you do that as a country boy moving to the city and looking around and saying, who can I talk to? Or did you have a connection that led you there?
Just a connection. Yeah, I think I was doing a little bit of carpentry up here, and then I went and worked for his brother, who I'd been, anyhow, it was a connection. I just fell into it, really. It was just circumstance.
And it's ended up being, the skills you learned have ended up being useful in your work on the farm.
Yeah, and from there, like, I went into kind of a bit of custom building. And that really, like, managing the trades and being close to the trades, that really paid off, because I had a good understanding of how mechanical systems work and just general systems thinking. I even spent a year doing maintenance on municipal buildings and stuff. So we were running their HVAC systems definitely paid off.
The skills that one learns at the time, you just think it's fun to do, and then later on you find out you're really glad you knew. You also went and studied. You went to, is it Selkirk College?
Yeah, the Selkirk Music Program. Yeah. I got in as a vocal major, because I didn't want to have to audition as a guitar player.
Well, of course. Well, who would want to do that?
Yeah, well, there was a lot of guitar players auditioning, and it was a pretty stiff competition. So I actually built the house for one of their vocal instructors. So it was a bit of an inside job there, getting me in.
So when were you building that house as part of the, of was that just sort of on the side? Oh, I think I'll build it. House too, wasn't it?
Totally random connection again. And I had been working for them for about 2 years on this really fancy custom home designed by David Dobie, who's a big architect down in the Kootenays. She had music students coming in and out because she would do her vocal lessons in her basement after we were part finished the house. And it just looked like fun.
Well, it sounds like a marvelous combination of two areas of interest, building things and playing music. Yeah. What kind of instruments did you, I don't know if the word specialize, but focus your attention on?
Just mainly the guitar and banjo at that time. I had a little band that I was one of the songwriters in, and I would switch back from guitar and banjo. And then I also was starting to get really interested in lap steel by the time I started farming. And then since then, I wanted to pick that up again. So,
isn't it wonderful how the law of serendipity leads us from one place to another, and we're never quite sure where the destination is, but it comes around the corner one day. Music in lots of settings. Your massive number one hit didn't happen, and so other things started to happen instead. Now, Annalise, you took off. You left as the people in Quebec would say, you left one country and went to the other, the La Belle Province de Québec, where you studied at Concordia University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What led you across the country? What led you to escape British Columbia?
I mean, it was partly random. It was partly a last minute decision. I wanted to go to university, and that was one of the few universities that I had applied to. And it was partly language. I studied French immersion. I really loved French, and I decided not to go into French university, but still the opportunity to work and live partly in French really appealed to me. And I just wanted to have kind of an independent adventure. I didn't really have any connections in Montreal. I didn't know anyone, and that was sort of what I wanted. I wanted to strike out on my own and build something myself.
You'd actually gone to Quebec too, hadn't you?
Stuff. Yeah, I went on the grade 10 exchange that I think still happens. Mm. It's a 3-month exchange. So wow. I spent 3 months outside of Quebec City. And then again, when I was 17, so the year between grade 11 and grade 12, it was the Canada Summer Work Exchange, something like that. Mm-hmm. And that was 6 weeks. And that was also an awesome experience, working as a camp counselor, actually in a Francophone part of Montreal. So
wonderful.
Yeah.
French culture is very different. And we'll talk about it a little bit further when we get to talking about things like organic food and how they handled Quebec versus how they handle it in most other parts of Canada. BC and Quebec are probably the two provinces that are most progressive with respect to that, as far as I understand. So there you are. I should mention, by the way, you told me that your mother was Danish-English and your father was Irish-Scottish, so there was not a single drop of Francophone blood in your veins.
Yeah, that's true, but both my grandma and my grandpa on my dad's side were both born in Quebec. So they were Anglophone Quebecers. Uh-huh. So when I went back to Quebec, one of my kind of best friend's roommates ended up being from the same town that my grandparents were from.
And were they English Quebecers that spoke French?
I mean, I'm sure. Maybe. I don't know. It depends at what generation you're talking about. Like the current generations, there's still a lot of cavers there. Mm. I'm sure that they all are bilingual. And they're all actually farmers also, but like conventional dairy farmers.
Yeah, we lived in Montreal for 7 years, and I had patients there who had proudly never learned a single word of French, which was astonishing to me as a bit of a francophile. Anyway,
yeah, didn't go well for the Air Canada CEO yesterday.
That's right. Steve, you were telling me that you were inspired by your dad because he was against, as you turned it, against sprays. Was that later or was it at the time? I mean, I know at the time you said, you know, adolescents are branching out, but do you find that that kind of stuck with you?
I think so. Yeah. I think that growing up, I mean, I say I didn't take much note of the organic grain production but I must have noticed to some degree, and I've just always thought that, you know, spraying stuff is not the way to do it. I don't know. So it must have stuck with me, yeah.
Well, it seems to be sticking all over the place now, which is good for your business. You moved back from Nelson and started the process of kind of building up a land base. What moved you to come, you know, to leave the world of music and building houses on the side?
You know, it's just, there's just transitions in life, and it just, the time came. I mean, it was a confluence of all sorts of events, and including a breakup and the band kind of breaking up as well, I guess, too. So that, you know, and the job I was in Nelson wasn't that rewarding, so I was looking for a way out of that.
Was that woodworking and
no, that was the maintenance.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I did that for almost a year, and it was mind numbing. It just not my field.
But it paid off.
Yes.
I said, yeah, I learned a lot of good stuff, it wasn't for me. There was a lot of patching up like holes in the wall in the police department. It's not really rewarding.
No, it doesn't make the front page of the newspaper or cause anybody anything other than not worrying about the hole in the wall anymore.
And I was terrible at it too. I just like
the wall is still there, is it?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, off in Montreal, Annalise, you were studying. Well, you went through two layers of study, a bachelor's and master's degree in urban planning, but you started out in environmental science.
Mm-hmm.
How did that metamorphose into urban planning?
So those at Concordia, those programs are in the same department. So there was some overlap, like I was taking geography classes with some urban planning students. But really what happened was I was talking to a friend who's quite a bit older than me. So she's 11 years older than me. So I was 18. She was 29. She had gotten a job in Kamloops in urban planning. And she was really, just really excited about it. And she just said to me, you know, if you really want to make a difference and plan more sustainable, you know, spaces and cities, this is the program that you should do. And from the outside, I thought, yeah, that sounds good, that sounds right. And then I did take a whole bunch of courses. Probably within 8 months, she had quit that job and was totally disillusioned with the field. She was working for a private contractor, not for a municipality. But by then I was already a year in, and I don't know. I did like the courses. I never really, from an early time, I didn't think that I would, that was necessarily my calling. But I forgot to mention, one of the reasons I moved to Montreal was because I loved the metro system. Moving from Kamloops to Montreal, like just the being able to go anywhere in the city. So, you know, I just loved it. So it was one of the things that
there. That's something we'll have to add to the list of Montreal's attractions. Using the subway. But you also did your thesis. You cleverly used your thesis to bring yourself back for a visit to British Columbia.
I think I did most of it by phone, actually. But yeah, I did. It was for my undergrad, so it was an honors thesis on the Kamloops Farmers Market, and I did it as an oral history, interviewing the founders of the market, which were a variety of characters, one of whom was my dad.
So, well, there you are. Sorry, yeah. Dad, I'm calling you to interview for my thesis.
But it was really, it was interesting to see, and it didn't bring me, I would say, any closer to urban planning necessarily, because I just saw the importance of the grassroots.
So what did you learn from doing the thesis, from talking to these interesting people, including your dad, probably talking to him about things that you wouldn't have been talking to him about when you were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing that I took away from that was really some of the regulatory hurdles that have existed since probably the early, I don't know, even in the 1940s, I guess, from talking to my family, the hurdles that exist for farmers to get their product to market or to get their product to consumers. It's just like the globalization of the food system, and even before that, when it was even more within the country or the continent, it's not straightforward. You can't just park on the street and sell veggies out of your truck, or park at Riverside Park in Kamloops and sell veggies out of your truck, which is what my dad was doing before the farmers market started. Right? There's no way.
Let me just make mention of something that just occurred about 3 days ago, and that is that the state of Maine, the United States, has just passed a constitutional amendment to its state's constitution that has established the right to food, the right to grow, produce, sell. Obviously, that's already available, but the right for everybody to be able to produce food. It's actually a bit of a breakthrough. And it's interesting that in both of your families, that's what you did, but you did it in a rural setting, and they're saying it can be done anywhere. It's a sign of a change of heart that is occurring on a broad scale. And you were looking at the process for people who grow food, who want to make a living out of it, how they can do that by moving outside this global sourcing system that has been such a bane to our, it's been a benefit in terms of making food widely available, but it's been a bane in terms of quality of food. Anyway, you were there in Montreal, but you were therefore on the far side of the country, so you had access to crossing the Atlantic, and you did a couple of times. Tell us a little bit about that. The Basque
just once,
country,
actually.
Sorry?
Just once. I just crossed the Atlantic once. But I stayed for 8 or 9 months. So I went on exchange to Sweden, and I did some courses on sustainable development there. And then I ended up volunteering on a farm there a little bit.
You were the chief carrot picker.
Well, the weekend carrot picker when everyone else was off work. And then I traveled a little bit more through Europe, England and Scotland and France. And then I did volunteer again on a farm in Spain for a few weeks.
And what was that like? You're seeing people in faraway places growing food. You're seeing different ways of doing it. How did that affect you? Like the Basque place was a well established co-op farm in a part of the world where co-ops have been remarkably effective and changing the perspective and lots of things. What was that like?
I mean, it was really an interesting place to stay. Lots of interesting characters. There were about five, I think, main co-op members, and they had as many different enterprises happening. So there was a goat dairy, and they made goat cheese on site. They had like a quesadilla, and they baked bread in a wood-fired oven, sourdough breads, which they distributed through another co-op structure as well. And then they grew veggies as well. That was a smaller part of their business, but they were incredibly self-sufficient. And I mean, it was a wonderful experience. It was also, I'm trying to think, I think it was maybe early April. I remember we arrived and it was so snowy that they couldn't pick us up from the bus station. And so we got there just basically as spring unfolded across the Basque country, and it was really beautiful. But yeah, it was a nice experience for sure.
So not to be outdone, Steve, you did your own share of traveling, And one of the places you ended up was on a cattle ranch in Australia.
Yeah.
They don't call them ranches, do they? What do they call them?
That was a station. Calvert Hills Station, I believe. 1.2 million acres.
Oh, small then.
Yeah, just a small one, really, as far as that goes. Yeah. No, that was a very formative experience.
So how did you get there, Steve?
Well, I've been traveling for, I think, 9 months at that point, maybe eight. So towards the end of my year of travel, and I was in Cairns, Australia. Girlfriend left to go back to Germany, so I was there figuring out what I was going to do next. And
lost and lonely.
yeah. And there was an ad in the hostel I was staying with for a ranch hand. I can't remember what it paid. It would have been something, but not very much. I seem to remember the
room and board.
They managed to take most of it at the general store where they sold cigarettes and beer. So, and I headed out into the outback, caught a ride with another worker who was leaving there who had a little VW combi, they called it, you know, the old station wagon. Mm-hmm. The camper van.
Yeah, the one that characterized the hippie era.
yeah. That was something else, just the trip out there, because it was, you know, God, thousands of kilometers down dirt roads. You know, you're heading into the heart of Australia. We got there, and luckily there's actually jobs there for us. We spent the first part of it working on fences, like repairing barbed wire fences. And I remember that ground was so hard. There was places where we had to get a proper fence post in, and we spent a day digging a fence post hole.
So you guys didn't have a post hole digger.
I don't know what the deal was. So why they didn't have an auger, maybe they just, labor was cheap. I don't know. But And then after like the first part of the stay there, then it was time to muster, and we spent the next, I don't know, maybe 3-4 weeks bringing in it was at least 4,000 cattle in a go from either quadrant of this giant property. And they had helicopters, they would call in their helicopter pilots, and then our job was to tail them with the dirt bikes.
I'm sorry, this is such a mixture of old and new technology.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Well, they were new dirt bikes. They're pretty nice. I had ridden a motorcycle a bit, but I'd never ridden a dirt bike. And I remember we were crossing creek beds with boulders, you know, bigger than your head. and then, of course, the calves would always, you know, that they lose their mothers and they go down, and we'd have to throw a calf on the back of a dirt bike and ride it in with the rest of the herd.
Honestly, I'm getting a lot of visuals out of this, Steve.
Yeah.
And they're very entertaining.
No, I just pulled up some of my old photos, and my favorite one is where the motorcycle rider we're with is literally about a hand's width from the skid of the helicopter, is working right over his head. Like, just unbelievably dangerous. I'm very glad I survived that.
So you said this was transformative and life-changing. I have a feeling that it was that you were not going to become an Australian outback station owner.
You know, at the time I knew I liked it. I didn't think that was my life path at any point, really, but I knew I liked it. Like, I was, you know, I'm not a big guy, and I, when we were doing the cattle handling, I ended up being the guy who was in a pen with 300, maybe 600 animals at a time, cutting off the bunch that's supposed to go into a smaller pen, and then from there they go into the chute, right? And so you're spending 8 to 10 hours running around in the Australian sun, getting charged by horned cattle, and I remember learning that, you know, when a cow charges you, and you're not within reach of the fence, you know, you don't run, right? You look dead at it and you reach for those horns. And if you miss those horns, you're done, right? So
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing. You're talking about life-threatening experiences.
I mean, I got it. It was the most thrilling thing I've ever done up to that point in my life. So, no, I knew I liked it, but it took me another 10 years to figure out that's what I wanted to do.
Steve, please, you must write a song at some point in your life about broiling in the Australian sun, carrying calves on the back of your dirt bike, and nearly getting chopped to bits by a chopper. It just sounds like it
would make a good song. There is some pretty good songs in Australia about a rancher from the top end, they'd call that.
Yes.
Or no, a ringer from the top end. I can't remember the name of that singer that wrote that song, but that was like our anthem to that.
I can see it. I can see it forming now.
Something Kelly, maybe? Anyhow.
So the two of you are sort of meandering around the planet, experiencing a variety of different things, some wonderful, some hair-raising. When did you actually meet? You don't have to give all the details. I'll just...
We met in 2014, 2014.
Yeah. I initially had met her brother through the Golden Ears farm sort of cooperative. And I think every year they did a corn roast that was kind of the year-end celebration. And I remember my first recollection was meeting her or seeing her being the host of the talent contest at this
and mine show. Is coming here to buy pig feed for our farm.
And did you obviously you did you get to realize that you had some parallel experiences in your lives when you got together, or was it just pure passion and no intellectual conversation?
I mean, I think we spent quite a bit of time together before we even went on a date.
Yeah.
But we met in 2014, and I don't know, we both had chosen farming as our sort of career, like not to say exclusively farming, but we both knew that food production was going to be a big...
Steve was
already doing it. He was running his business, and I was just sort of making that choice over the course of those years since I moved back to BC, that it was what I found to be most fulfilling. And and then our paths converged.
So let's ask, I'd like to ask each of you, what was it about farming, Annelise, that made it seem like the right thing for you? What was it?
I mean, really, I think just it's the most fulfilling thing that I've still ever done in its entirety. So there are other things that I enjoy doing in life, but then there's some things about them it doesn't totally fill my cup, or I don't feel like I'm providing something valuable to my community and to the world. And so farming...
Were you thinking that before you began farming, though? Obviously, you hadn't had the experience, but there was some. What was it about farming? You said to me at one point that you had a passion for production, and added that with farming, the reward is so visible. You see the outcome of your effort. Is that is that what you were thinking before you'd actually got into it? Like, well, I want to do something I can produce something from.
Yeah. So before I had really gotten into it in a more permanent way, I did come back from Montreal at least 2 summers and work on my family's farm, like at the Golden Ears farm, which was then sort of a loosely structured co-op. And for part of the time I was actually planning, like I was just going to work in the fruit stand, basically doing the retail, which they had as a paid job, as opposed to being a co-op member. But I ended up working on the farm so much and really enjoying it. And then going back to the city and feeling like, and going back to the city and back to university and back to a desk and a computer and wondering what I was doing there and just feeling a sort of sense of, not being fulfilled.
Well, it's those feelings that drive us, and it obviously has driven you in a big way as time has gone by. Now, meantime, Steve, you were one way or another assembling the farm, literally, in practical terms, after you came back from Nelson. Why don't you describe that process? Because it was an interesting and somewhat complicated process.
I suppose. I mean, I the way I view it is I just fell into it. I mean, there was all these resources, like, you know, from what my dad had been doing before he started running a gravel pit. We also have a gravel pit on the farm, and slowly he sort of moved into that area of it and left the farming behind. And it was just what resources I have. Including tractors and implements to grow grain and implements to harvest hay and just taking all these pieces and going like, how can I make an actual living with this stuff in a way that's sustainable, you know, that it wasn't for my family ever really, you know. I didn't want to work two jobs. I never wanted to work off the farm. You know, I played around with lots of stuff.
You also acquired some extra land.
Yes, there's that story too. That happened at the same time. It's not exactly, like, to me, it doesn't feel like extra land because we always had two quarter sections here, like my whole life. But then my uncle, or my dad's uncle, I guess that makes him my cousin,
great uncle.
He was kind of a silent partner in the half that property. And then one day he just up and decides to sell it. And we didn't want to pay what he thought he could get at the time. So then we ended up with a quarter section that was the next one down. So now we're in a position of not exactly having a bigger farm, but having one farm that's no longer contiguous. But the new farm had a house on it. So that was a bonus for us.
And it was also considered less expensive for you?
We got it on a pretty good deal on it.
Yeah.
I mean, by today's standards, we got it for you know, less than you could buy a house in town for.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
That's pretty amazing. But yeah.
So were you in the house right away, or that was a gradual process? As you
know? No, I had a fifth wheel trailer I moved into. When we first got the place, and then my sister and her family, she had at the time four and almost five kids.
Yeah.
She just didn't like living in the country. So, her and her internet developer, husband moved to Kelowna. So
we'll speak with hushed voices at this point, won't we? Internet real estate developer. So you had kind of been putting it, and I understand the farm had been in your family, one part of it being in family, for nearly a century.
Yeah, we're looking at having our centennial next year on that farm. And my grandparents are both living in what would have been the original farmhouse if it hadn't have burnt down in
1938.
Yeah.
So, and his grandpa Martin, who's 94 this year, was born in that house.
My goodness.
Yeah.
That was a time when people did stuff like that on a regular basis. Now we do it, but irregularly. So 2014, you've met, you're both keen to do farming. How were things initially set up? Like, what was the kind of living arrangement? You moved onto the farm, you lived in the house. How did that work?
So Steve was living in the house in 2013 already.
Yeah.
And then in 2014, I guess, in the fall of 2014, I worked just a short stint in Armstrong. And this is before we were actually dating or together. Yeah. And so I lived here as a roommate. Like, we had other roommates too, and they were all working in farming. It was a really fun time, actually.
Yeah.
everyone had agricultural connections. Like there was a herds, our friend Molly was the kind of herds person for terroir cheese. They had a small, they had a small herd. They were just milking 23 cows, just close to here. Indeed. And Elizabeth, the other roommate, she was doing retail sales for, she's doing retail sales for Terroir. And she also did a lot of work for Steve, like design graphics. She would do chores sometimes. Like she moved here because she loved pigs. And by that time, Steve had pigs and chickens. And Elizabeth and Molly and I all processed chickens sometimes that, like starting that summer. So,
and meanwhile, we had all kinds of sort of woofers or
workaway
people staying here too. So it was it was a busy place.
Yeah, it was a full house of like late 20s, early 30s.
It's interesting people. When you think about the kind of household you had. It was a household of people engaged in right. up to their necks in farming activities one way or another. It's not unusual for people in that age range to get together and have a kind of a collective housing arrangement, but it is unusual for you all to be so embedded in food food production.
It's interesting to note that this is right around the time that the Young Agrarians was forming in DC. And a lot of us connected through one of the first ever, they called it mixers in Kelowna.
Mixers.
So that definitely had an impact on the way things shaped up.
How did it, what kind of impact? It must have given you some encouragement, some sense that there was, you weren't sort of branching out on your own in a strange world.
Well, you weren't, I mean, you imagine being a 20 or almost 30 year old moving back to Armstrong, wanting to work on the farm, but that, you know, I'm used to living in Nelson where it's like, you know, there's people my age doing all kinds of interesting things everywhere you look. And then it felt a little bit, bit isolating to move back to the farm. Right. And to the Okanagan where it's not the same culture, you know,
the culture in the Kootenays is known around the world.
So having that support, it maybe kept me interested in it when I might not have been, you know, I might have just got over being alone in the Okanagan, so to speak, right?
Well, I think the world is going to be grateful that you met that supportive group of young farmers and that it's motivated to do what you're doing now. By just before the two of you got together, 2013, that's, I believe, when the farm structure was more or less fully formed. But, and also, in addition to starting up a farm, you also started up a family. And that's an enterprise that most people consider pretty close to a full-time occupation. But you also were starting up this farming operation. How did the two blend together, raising a family, but also thinking about having a family with young children in a farm where you're trying to grow food the right way? You're trying to grow food that will nourish them as well as the world. This is sort of a collection of circumstances all coming together in kind of a focal point.
So I would say while it is a really amazing experience, I think for a whole family and for kids to grow up on a farm, it's also really easy to idealize what it's going to be like.
Yes. And we're talking about no sleep.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, some tough.
Yeah. Yeah. The lack of sleep. But also just imagining like what you think you can do with children and then what happens in actual fact, you know, it's like
it's always a choice of what you know what ball you let drop, right?
Of course. I think both of us are really hard workers, and so then when you get to work on something, there's often interruptions. Anyways, it's like it's just those unexpected things.
The generic term is stressors.
But to answer your question in another aspect, we it definitely, I think, pushed me towards organics because, you know, our kids were eating the food, you know, primarily it's food we produce. So, you know,
indeed.
I don't want to be feeding them grain that's been sprayed with glyphosate, you know.
For sure.
I want our kids to have a good start. Mm-hmm. And not have the threat of lymphoma.
Yeah. And I think the early years, like when Steve was, he had already started really building the market that we still have today, the customer base, sort of our larger support network. And at the time, it was hard to make the decision to go fully organic with the price point that we would have to increase it to. And since then, I think it was a combination of us really aligning our principles and values with, or aligning our business more closely with our principles and values in becoming certified organic. But also, like, we did have a conversation that was basically, if people don't want to buy this, we will produce less.
Yeah.
And like, that's, you know, maybe we'll, but that it hasn't been the case at all. Like the interest in organics is definitely.
Let's say it's skyrocketing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think that's probably accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we wholeheartedly believe in the importance of it too, which helps us sell it.
Yeah.
Of course. And I think that's a way of running a business that has become a hallmark of what is generally called the millennial sort of spirit. I mean, I don't know what millennial is. There's a millennium every 1,000 years. but the idea that the work you do is closely aligned with your deeper values, not just, you know, you like to live in a certain place because it's a pleasant place to live, but you want to live in a way that feels like it's contributing something positive to the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's good for listeners to hear people say that you can't idealize it, really. You have to live it, and when you live it, it's just mm-hmm. like everything else. Every day brings new surprises, some good, some not so good, and you just have to roll with a punch. Now, about 3 years ago, you all went as a family to California. Now, you know, the convention is that people from California come north for the gold rush. You went down to California to a conference.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's actually, to be clear, I have roots in California on both sides. My great-grandpa was originally from Orange County, and they had a great big ranch there, and that's a whole nother story. But then my mom grew up in California, so I've been there a lot.
So this is his paternal grandfather, and then his maternal side is also in California. Anyways.
Yeah, anyhow.
So that's the only reason you went to California.
No, but we had relatives there to visit.
It made it easier.
Yeah. But anyhow, me and my friend, our friend, Tristan Banwell, he runs Spray Creek Ranch in Lillooet, and we both, and Alvin, should mention his partner, we run similar farms, you know, pretty much. They're a bit bigger.
I should just mention for listeners that Andrea Gunner was on a show recently, and she talked at length about Tristan and Auburn and their farm. And so I think it's very good because it just shows that when people have like minds, they co-locate, they get together. So there you are in California with Tristan and
anyhow,
Auburn.
So we decided to go with the farmers from Spray Creek. So it's a big family. I mean, they had one child at the time.
Yeah.
It was quite the outing for two farm families down there. Anyhow, so the grass-fed exchange is one of the biggest gatherings of mostly cattle ranchers, cattle and sheep ranchers practicing regenerative practices.
But there were large-scale poultry producers too. Basically, pasture-raised livestock. Period. I mean,
of all sorts.
Focus on ruminants.
Yeah, people who grow grass is the main thing. The grass-fed exchange,
for sure.
Yeah, and I mean that was, I mean it was, It was interesting in lots of ways, and we made some great connections. Also a little bit disheartening to see that you know, they're still just people looking for attention in some ways.
How do you mean that, Steve?
Oh, you know, like the people who have farms, like Joel Salatin, who, oh, okay. You know, they talk a big game, right? And there's a lot of that. And there's who is that doctor who's
we don't need to
get into the conspiracy end of things, but yeah, there's fringe thinkers of all sorts in that movement, and yeah, so I don't know if I would go back to another one of those conferences, but there's plenty of good things that happen here in Canada about regenerative agriculture, and I would sooner go to one in Alberta or BC.
Which, just to be clear, for us, like, the basis of any kind of regenerative agriculture is organic.
For sure.
That's sort of a fundamental. Well, I don't think that that's a given in every context, and including in, yeah.
Yeah, it's an experience, for sure.
It's interesting you raise the point about organic, because organic is sort of a way of defining in a very structured way how you grow food. But a lot of people have done what you were doing before you sought certification and before you obtained certification. You were already making changes, dramatic changes, in the way you were growing. And it isn't always easy to get certification, but it's easy to do the changes that you need to do to make healthier food. It just that it becomes a marketing issue. If you can declare certified organic, it changes things. In Quebec, there's a system where you can have graded degrees of organic farming. And I think you mentioned that on your website, that you can be almost organic, meaning you've done 2 of the 3 years, say. And in Quebec, you can get status as that. But in BC, I don't think you can you? You don't get status until you're actually certified.
So there's, in BC, you can be transitional organic. Yeah. And I think that sort of classification will depend on the certifying body, mm-hmm. somewhat, but also on the land. So for us, because there had been no prohibited substances applied to the land, like, for all intents and purposes, our beef production did not change at all.
Sure.
The grass was treated, not treated the same. But then for a veggie farm that has had prohibited substances applied, they would only be able to be called transitional organic in their third year. So it's, yeah.
And I don't think in BC you can sort of put a sign up saying, you know, year two or year one.
Yeah.
Can you?
You can, actually. Yeah. So you get your certification number, like, from your certifying body when you first apply and have your application accepted. They'll issue a certificate that says what sort of status,
what level of status you've attained.
Yeah, or a letter, maybe not a certificate, unless you're close to or certified.
The trend, and when we were talking before, I asked Steve a couple of different ways, if the trend that society around you is manifesting is leading to more interest, more a larger market, a greater security for people growing food the way you guys are growing it. And I teased out of him, yes, it is, although he said it's mostly in Kelowna. But mm-hmm. I wonder if just generally, as we're coming to the end of the show, you could just make a few comments about that, about the fact that when you started, you didn't know, but now you do know that things are getting better for people growing food the way you're growing it. I mean, you're still tired and you still don't get any sleep, but...
Well, I do think it's really case by case. I think we, I think a lot of... So it does feel fairly easy to us to grow our market, but that has a lot to do, so much has to do with word of mouth. And so making those initial contacts
and market saturation. I mean, we walked into the market at the exact time that Dale Farms retired.
Which was the organic beef in the central and north Okanagan.
Yeah. I mean, it's still a limited market for the really high end stuff, but but it does. Local certainly seems to be growing. I think that organics still needs to do more work in establishing itself as the regenerative, you know, option, because they're not always the same thing. But I think that there's a growth in that concept of regenerative farming, maybe not as much in the ideals of regular organics. So it's important that we jump on that right now.
Do you feel, and we'll talk more about how you run the farm and what it's like on a day-to-day basis in our next show, but do you feel sort of essentially optimistic about how things are going? Do you feel that things are changing in the right direction?
You're asking at the end of one of the hardest seasons in terms of production.
Indeed.
On record. That doesn't give us a lot of hope. If next year's different, then yeah. But no, it was a tough year. I never dreamed of having the irrigation running full on all year like that. And we just have two creeks, and it was barely enough to make the grass grow. These sure. two creeks.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that you're, and I actually can tell you that climate change is producing massive effects, but they aren't linear. They are off and on, and they sometimes are disastrous, and then other times they're not. And I think we'll all be facing those problems, so we'll all have to adjust to them, and that will make us more sympathetic to your plight if it's a bad year. The show's coming to an end today. Thank you very much for being on it. We look forward to talking again about a beautiful Fresh Valley farm arrangement and how you make it work. Thank you very much, both Annalise and Stephen. We'll talk to you.
Thanks, again. Warren, for having us.
A pleasure.
This new series of Food Conversations for the fall of 2021 are produced by Shelley Corbin, Warren Bell, and Steve Corey. And the idea came from Melanie Bennett in collaboration with the Shuswap Food Action Society. Check out their website.